This podcast is brought to you by GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, protecting consumers and supporting the global gem and jewelry trade since 1931 through research, education, and laboratory services.
Welcome to the Rappaport Diamond Podcast, and now your host, Joshua Friedman.
Hi, I'm Joshua Friedman, Senior Analyst at Rappaport. On this episode of the Rappaport Diamond Podcast, I was joined by Hans Merkert, researcher at IPIS, the International Peace Information Service, and an expert in conflict diamonds and the Kimberley process. Based in Antwerp, IPIS is a member of the Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition, the group of non-profits that participate in the KP. Hans spoke about what he believes are the failings of the Kimberley process, why it needs to be more transparent, the Central African Republic, and of course, the fallout from the Russia-Ukraine war. While we are publishing this episode just ahead of the KP's intersessional meeting in Dubai, which begins on May the 13th, we recorded it in early March, so some of the facts on the ground might have developed since then. Enjoy the episode. So welcome to you, Hans. Great to have you on the Rappaport Diamond Podcast. I hear you've just returned from a visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And indeed, I just came back a few days ago. It was quite an interesting visit, as my organization or I had ever been in the diamond mining area of Congo. And it was very interesting to see how things go there. Also, quite striking how little is known about it. So it was really an eye-opener.
Right. I want to hear a little bit about the IPIS, what you do and what the organization does. Could you explain that to me and our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So IPIS is a research NGO. We mainly look at the link between natural resource exploitation on the one hand and issues of conflict, development and human rights on the other, with a focus on African producer countries, where we always try to work in close partnership with in-country stakeholders, mainly civil society, but also government partners in the mining sector, for instance. And I think over the years, we've become specialized in collecting data in quite complex environments, often remote areas or places where it just the conditions don't make it very easy to do research.
So you work with the Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition. Can you also give us a bit of a rundown on what the role of that is?
Yeah, so IPIS is a member of the Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition since 2016. The coalition is mainly a grouping of African civil society organizations from about 10 different African countries. I think it's about 14 organizations. And IPIS, so we're the only non-African member, a bit perhaps because we're not really an advocacy NGO, but more of a research center. So we try to support the coalition with our research and also more logistically and organizational issues. The Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition is at its core a watchdog, let's say. It plays an observer role in the Kimberley process, but it adds a few tasks on top of that, also given that it has become quite critical of where the Kimberley process is going and what relevance its certification scheme still has. So the coalition also tries to use the Kimberley process and its meetings as an agenda setting moment to raise attention for issues that otherwise don't get or don't attract a lot of interest through speeches, opening statements. We have, for instance, put the problem of tailing dam breaches that had a devastating impact on communities. We also try to, and that's particularly for our African friends, it's a very good opportunity for them to do also national level advocacy, because in these meetings, they can meet their government counterparts, which are often very difficult to access on the country level. It also gives them legitimacy, credibility, and safety to work on difficult topics. So that it is, in a way, a balancing exercise between playing this watchdog role, because without a coalition who would do it for civil society, but on the other hand, also try to avoid that we contribute to legitimizing the flaws we find that exist in the certification scheme.
Thanks, Hans. There's obviously a lot of, we could call it civil society or sustainability issues in the diamond industry at the moment. Obviously, that everyone's talking about at the moment is Russia-Ukraine, which I think we're going to touch on this very briefly. But there are a few other things going on that maybe have got a little less attention in the last year because of the whole Russia question. Well, what are the most important issues of these type in the industry right now?
I think a key one, and that's also one that goes to the core of what the Kimberley process is doing, of course, is the problem of the Central African Republic, which is likely to be in the spotlight also this year, because there's really a fight ongoing on the KP or on the international level of how to deal with this, to deal with the fact that the country has had an embargo imposed on it for over 10 years now. That has been, so it was imposed on 2013 when civil war broke out. Between 2016 and 2019, it has been relaxed in a few phases, allowing exports from certain zones, also reducing the restrictions that the KP imposed on it. Since then, the file has really been stuck, and that coincides also with the arrival of Wagner mercenaries in the CER and with an increased Russian interest in the country. So that made geopolitics enter this already very complex file, and that, of course, wasn't helpful. I think an overall problem with embargoes of the Kimberley process, or more generally, is that if they don't come with accompanying measures or with a kind of roadmap for the long term, they never actually lead to reducing diamond production. They lead to increased smuggling. So the diamonds continue to be mined and they find out a way out of the country through other means. And that's even worse if the government itself of the respective country doesn't support the sanctions, which is today the case in the CER. And there in the Central African Republic, it has taken giant proportions, this smuggling and illegality. It's really become a gangster's paradise with massive corruption, terrorist financing through the diamond trade, rebels that continue to interfere in diamond mines. There's, of course, mercenaries now that play a role. And all of this doesn't go away when you lift the embargo, as is now being proposed by, for instance, the KP chair that is this year, the United Arab Emirates, because these illegal networks have become very well established in the country. They are closely intertwined with elites. They have really whole logistical framework set up. You want to give the formal trade more breathing space, but by lifting the embargo, you won't do that because it's too hard to compete with these illegal networks that don't have to pay taxes and so on. I think the big challenge, how can you give more breathing space to the formal trade? Gradually, I think, rather than any drastic measure that would risk to undo the very fragile progress that has been booked over very slowly, unfortunately, over a very long time.
So is there a roadmap in place for the CAR?
Not really. There is an operational framework, the KP calls it, and that stipulates the monitoring requirements. But it basically, the information the CAR government has to send to the Kimberley process, but it does not have a long-term vision. We are not really looking at how can we continue to build on the formal trade has been increasing. There is some contamination with conflict diamonds that come from the east of the country, but still it's not foolproof, but there has been some progress. I think the differences of opinion are simply too large, and there is insufficient interest, in my view, in engaging with the problems of the CER. There's really an attitude of trying to pull your hands off, and actually that's probably quite paradoxically, that's the attitude of both those who shout very loud to lift the embargo or those who want to maintain it. Because lifting the embargo means that you deny that any of these problems still exist. While maintaining it, you pretend as if the KP has everything under control and that there's no conflict diamonds anymore, that succeeds in stopping all conflict diamonds from reaching the international trade. So yeah, there's little nuance, I think, in the debate today. It's maybe overtly dramatized, which doesn't help to make progress.
How has the geopolitical aspect, how has that complicated things? Could you just explain that, the presence of the Wagner group, Russian interests, how has that complicated things?
It used to be, so the Kimberley process has a monitoring team dedicated to supervising the exports from the Central African Republic. It used to be quite a technical team that was really looking, it has a group of diamond experts, mainly from the industry, that analyze the footprint to see whether this matches the footprint of diamonds from the West, where the CER can export. So a very technical work where you could discuss specific issues with implementing the operational framework. There were problems, for instance, with the picture quality that the CER used to send photographs of the diamonds for exports that didn't allow the experts to really analyze these diamonds very well. Then they invested in better photograph material for the CER. These kind of issues, so quite not necessarily easy, but there was always a way to deal with it. Then from 2019, I think 2020, Russia also became a member or an observer member of the monitoring team. And from that, and I think together with the changes on the international level, that meant that every discussion in this group became political and you really saw the lack of trust entering. And if there's no trust anymore, then there's no constructive attitude anymore. And at present, it's, for instance, the CER government has little faith or trust in the monitoring team and vice versa. While to find a way out of this crisis, they need to work together. And that is currently being very difficult. And you see that any mistrust is also, there's lots of politics behind it. I think also on the side of the CER government, it's often difficult to follow these discussions because there's so many hidden agendas that you don't often know where things are headed. Maybe one last point on that, the Kimberley process hasn't been in the CER as a delegation since 2016, I think. Now the KP chair went there on his own initiative. It's not really the same thing as if you send a delegation from the Kimberley process. But there has been a plan to go since 2019, but also there a lack of trust has prevented this visit to take place for over 4 years now, which of course without such a visit, even if you, it's not by a one-time visit to a country that you can assess the security situation because these visits are evidently orchestrated, but it can help to build trust, to show an interest still in finding a solution, and that is not happening.
In practice, are there still diamonds being mined in the CAR that would count as conflict diamonds that are funding rebel groups or conflict?
There's very little intelligence data coming out of the CAR right now. Let's say that the KP is steering blind because of a few reasons. The main source of intelligence for the KP is the UN. You have a panel of experts. They have struggled with their mandate renewal for a while. They have very little resources to travel. Also, that is politics, but on the level of the UN Security Council. There's MINUSCA that used to come, but there's some, I don't know, the relationship between the KP and MINUSCA also seems to be difficult.
Excuse my ignorance, who's MINUSCA?
The MINUSCA is the United Nations peacekeeping operations for the CER. And also, so civil society, many international within the country used to do a lot of monitoring research. But given the security situation at present, with also mercenaries everywhere, there's very little civil society monitoring being done. So there are ad hoc reports. And from these reports, you hear that rebel groups have been pushed out by Wagner and the government from many cities. But of course, diamond mining and gold mining happens in quite remote areas. And there's less control. There was, for instance, a case of, it was on a gold mine, but often these mines are quite similar and overlap. There were 8 Chinese nationals that were killed by rebels, I think early last year, which shows still, it's like these ad hoc reports that indicate problems rather than that we have an overall view of the situation. That's when we talk about classic conflict diamonds. The fact, of course, that there are lots of human rights abuses being committed in diamond mining zones by mercenaries and the government army in gaining control over these mines is also problematic from a conflict perspective. They don't have their own diamond mining operations, but they use violence and intimidation to force artisanal miners to sell diamonds to their traders at often drastically reduced prices, which can then also be seen as a form of forced labor and so on. So there's definitely still reason for concern. The government managed to push back rebels considerably, but that unfortunately wasn't an end to violence in diamond mining areas.
Right. Outside of the Central African Republic, who has an interest in there being supply from the CAR? I mean, obviously, I understand why the Central African Republic wants to be able to export diamonds, but who outside of the CAR has an interest in there being production coming to the market from the CAR? Are there companies that have historically worked with CAR that currently don't have any business because of this? What reason is there for anyone outside the CAR to get its production back on stream?
Yeah, I see. I think that the reason, a lot of the motivations by those pushing to lift the embargo are mainly political. It's a populist motive as well to gain support from African countries as well. In general, there's a lot of support from other African producer countries for the CAR because they feel normally a KP embargo is invited by the country itself. It's when the country feels threatened by rebels, they ask an embargo in order to stop rebels from financing themselves through these diamonds so that they can't overthrow the government. This situation has changed now in the CAR because the rebels pose less of a risk to the security of the regime, but it's still a conflict scenario. And African countries are very sensitive to sovereignty. And I think all countries in the KP that feel that these countries or others are imposing their rules on them, they support it. So I think it's also a way to gather support. On the other hand, the diamonds from the CER were, over 10 years ago, were highly valued on the market. They are known for having very good quality diamonds. They were in the top, I think, five of countries with the highest value to volume ratio of diamonds, so highest value per carat. So there is, of course, an interest in the trade in these diamonds, but I think it's more politics than commercial interest at play.
And this brings us to the seemingly never-ending debate around the definition of conflict diamonds. Almost every year, if not more, there are discussions to change the definition, to broaden it to human rights abuses by governments themselves rather than just by rebel groups. Where is that going? Is there any end in sight for that?
Yeah, so it's indeed the Kimberley process normally has a review cycle every 5 years, and these cycles tend to last 3 years. So it's nearly, there's always only 2 years in between that there's no talk of reform. And this discussion of conflict diamonds is always central. I think for now, there's a bit more debate on language than there used to be, because otherwise there's already lots of countries disputing simply the fact that there is a discussion. I think the discussion is accepted now. I'm not very hopeful on where it's going and whether it will lead to anything. I think at the very best, when we're very optimistic, there might be a small update in language, also still unsure, and then it would more be to expand the number of actors that are involved in conflict, but mainly to include not just rebels, but also criminals or terrorists in the definition. It's really a no-go within the KP to mention government responsibility for conflict. So when a scenario in which the police or the army uses systematic violence to protect industrial concessions, for instance, is not acceptable for many as it intrudes too much on sovereignty. The same, of course, for when a government attacks another government, as we see in the Russia-Ukraine war. So I think that is still the area where nothing can happen. Human rights used to be more of a taboo in the KP. Now the Kimberley process adopted a framework on responsible sourcing that accepts human rights as an important principle, but also there's no commitment attached to that. So they recognize the principle. It's now also seen a bit as a, in my view, as an excuse to say we have this framework and we acknowledge the principle, so we don't need to include a definition. So yeah, not the most interesting discussions to follow often.
This podcast is brought to you by GIA. Consumer trust is vital to the global gem and jewelry industry from mine to market. Through research, education, instrument development, and independent gem grading and identification, GIA is dedicated to protecting consumers, ensuring their trust in gems and jewelry, and helping the industry thrive. Visit gia.edu for more information.
Looking at this from the outside, what we see is that the reason for this constant, you could call it stalemate, is the rule that any country can veto any proposal or any decision. I mean, is that something that's here to stay, the consensus principle rule, the KP?
I think it's impossible to change this consensus rule because it's, of course, part of the compromise that means that so many countries can participate in the KP because they all know that nothing will be accepted against their will, or there will never be consensus on changing that rule, let's say. Also because even from, let's say, the more progressive countries, when you look at the Western countries, they are often in a minority in decision-making when it comes to changing the rules. And so they are also protected by this. The consensus model is in theory a good model because it allows to build compromise. The problem within the KP is that it's used as a veto power, which it shouldn't be. It should be a way to look for compromise. Now it's a way to block any discussion. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's become so problematic in the KP is the very strict confidentiality rules within the KP, which means that there's no transparency. Basically, as an observer, we're not allowed to reveal positions that governments take within KP meetings, which means that everyone can use this veto power without having to be accountable for it. They don't even have to explain why they're against the decision. They can just simply say no, and nobody will ever question them because it's unknown who is against or who is in favor. So I think it's more feasible, realistic to go for more transparency within the KP, open up this, it's a very isolated entity that is detached from reality, open up, make these meetings publicly accessible, stop with all the hiding. There's a lot of documents circulating. They're all protected from the public by confidentiality rules. I think transparency is a more realistic aim to go for.
Interesting. Just a couple of questions that just came to my mind. Firstly, are you saying that the originally the countries' governments did not use the consensus arrangement to veto things, and that it later turned into a veto?
Yeah, that's originally there was much more creativity within the Kimberley process to try and come up with compromise. When you look at the history, for instance, with Zimbabwe and Marange Diamonds, it's not a beautiful history to look at for the KP, of course, but at least they were trying to, there were competing interests. There were countries who wanted an embargo. There were others who wanted the KP would in no way interfere with Zimbabwe Diamonds. And they came up with some kind of monitoring framework and look at how can we reconcile these objectives. It's not beautiful, but at least something happened. Today, you see that there's very little creativity or willingness to try and find solutions. It's simply you block a discussion. That's how the previous reform cycle ended on the conflict diamond definition. We never knew why countries objected. They never had to give their reason. They simply said, this doesn't work for me, or I want to touch base with my capital, and they never did. So that goes against, I think the main reason is there's a lot of mistrust within the KP. So everybody is afraid that admitting to one thing might be used against them. So it has become a very legalistic setting where all discussions are about language, about commas, about words that can be used, that can be interpreted to mean something else than they would initially, and so on.
Can you estimate when this changed and why it changed?
I think, well, there's definitely more to it than I've only been around also following these discussions since 2018. And I think from them, I started seeing that more often and it became worse. I think one of the reasons is also that a lot of the, let's say, founding fathers of the Kimberley process left. So many people end up in this. They get some handover from their colleagues, but they don't really know what all of this is. All the people who I hear that participate for the first time, I'm shocked about how this geopolitics, this how everything is blocked. That is one thing. I think another element is also the fact that it used to be more diplomats involved in the Kimberley process meetings who were trained on building compromise. While today, there's hardly any diplomats that still attend. It's mainly technical staff from mining ministries or from trading ministries, depending on where in the supply chain a country is. And that also doesn't help because these are people that have a very specific scope of work and don't see the larger picture or the needs for international cooperation or have just come from a different background. So I think that also didn't help and led to this change. I think it's an evolution. It's probably something that has been ongoing for 10 years already, but that became ever more difficult.
I'm pleased that we've spoken a lot about issues other than Russia and Ukraine, given how much coverage there's been in our other podcasts and other products about that. But I did want to ask about the last plenary meeting. I know there might be a limit to what you can say on a podcast about this, but it ended without a communique, as we understand, because of a disagreement about how to address the issue of Russia and Ukraine in that communique, in that document that's put out after the meeting. What can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, I think overall it's often being portrayed as if it was just about some words in a piece of paper and nothing much. I don't think that's true. There's really a big difference of opinion on how to move forward with the Kimberley process. And I think particularly the Western countries, G7, or how you want to name them, they're in a very difficult position right now because they are uncomfortable with the fact that they are contributing to a certification scheme that is helping to whitewash Russian diamonds as conflict-free. On the other hand, they cannot leave this scheme because their own diamond interests depend on it, but also because this is a very important scheme for many African producer countries or India as a trading and a manufacturing country. And they don't want to damage those relationships that are already very complicated. So they feel they have to continue with the KP, but complement it with, I think, on the one hand, their own initiative, which now is the G7 traceability scheme that entered into force, but also they want to keep it on record that they oppose Russia within the Kimberley process. They feel that they need to do that for their legitimacy, their credibility within this framework, while many other countries see it as politicizing the KP and see the G7 scheme as undermining the foundations of the KP. And these are sentiments that are being fed by also those who oppose transparency, traceability, of course, also by Russia, but there are others. I think it's a war that, or a battle, let's say, that cannot be won, but that can also not end as long as this geopolitical tension and this war in Ukraine continues. So it will continue to cast a dark shadow over the KP because simply there's too many competing interests at play. And that, even more than before, means, unfortunately, that there's very little content being discussed within Kimberley Process meetings. It's all either it's blocked or it's technical issues managed to go through. The creation of a KP secretariat, it's something quite technical that can happen. But any broader issue on definition discussions are more complex because of this reality that now has a very concrete example of what a larger conflict diamond definition could be. Discussions on the Central African Republic are even more complicated because it interferes. There are links between the Central African Republic and the war in Ukraine. So it makes everything more complicated.
So you're saying that when countries like Ukraine, US, Canada, and a few others sent letters to the KP, I think one of them was right before plenary in November, that was they weren't actually expecting to change anything, to exclude Russia from the Kimberley process or anything like that. It was really just they wanted to get in writing and on record, maybe in Reuters as well, that they opposed, that they were uncomfortable about the fact that Russian diamonds were still being able to be exported with KP certificates.
Yeah, indeed. I think everybody knew from the start it's impossible to have a consensus on any KP action towards Russia. So it's in part, indeed, as you say, to have their opposition on record in writing, but also to use, I think, every arena that exists to discuss, to try and have a discussion on this. I believe they would all want to have a debate within the Kimberley process on this issue to avoid that this is being silenced because of vetoes. So that if there's one thing that perhaps there's some belief that is possible is to have a frank discussion on how diamonds are contributing to the war in Ukraine, to also enrich conflict diamonds discussion. It's all linked, of course, but to work towards change within the Kimberley process, you also need to have public interest and public pressure. So I think as long as the KP continues to be so alienated from the public debate because it's such a complex technical issue, it will be very hard to have the necessary public pressure to move towards changes. So, of course, this also helps to get some more media attention. It's always quite limited, I think, the media attention outside of the diamond industry, of course, where there's lots of attention, but from mainstream media, there's little interest. So any effort to get more interest into the failings of the KP can help to address this failing. So I think that's also part of the rationale behind it.
You mentioned before the KP secretariat. What benefits would that bring?
Maybe both benefits and some new risks as well. I think the benefit mainly it's more professionalism for the organization, which is a disaster right now. When you look at the website of the KP, it's completely out of date. It's very ad hoc which reports are put online and which ones aren't, which is overall bad for transparency. Try to find some information on that website. It's really a nightmare. Also, there's generally a lot of amateurism in document management. So people will claim they have not seen an email or a document, and you can block an entire discussion and move it forward to a next meeting, which might be held in a few months. So hopefully this can help to avoid excuses about access to documents that would block discussions.
We do not have the KP website developer or anyone involved in the KP here to defend themselves. So I just point that out.
I think there is today nobody running the website. The ones that are doing it against all odds because there isn't really support for it. So it's currently not being updated. Even the statistics that are online, they are a few years old. They haven't been refreshed the past years. I think the risk that is there for the secretariat is that it was very important in the design. Everybody agreed that it should be non-political, that it should be purely administrative. That will be a constant exercise to keep guarding that and to make sure, because it will be representative that will become executive secretary of the KP. So then you need certain safeguards to ensure that this person doesn't listen more to his own government than to others, for instance, within the KP.
What about the fact that the chair of the KP changes every year? I mean, I guess the secretariat in some way is there to deal with that fact, but is that disruptive to the KP?
The secretariat will, as it has purely administrative functions, it will not change the rotation of the KP chair, which is more of a political function, but which used to also take on the administrative tasks. So the problem that, for instance, website management changes every year to a new entity, that wasn't helpful. The rotating presidency, I think, is not necessarily a bad thing because it allows always a fresh approach. It allows everybody to take the lead in this process. The problem is that it has become very expensive, I think, to become KP chair because you're expected to host and organize all these meetings. And KP meetings have over the years become sideline activities have been added. There's a lot of gala dinners, drinks, tourist excursions, and so on. For many countries, this is a big burden to pay for it. It's not an obligation, but of course, the bar has been set. and many countries feel this is difficult. So you see that it's often the same countries now coming back. It would be interesting if some other producer countries that maybe don't have the resources could work together with a few countries to host it, or that we would just lower the bar again.
Right. I don't want to put you in a difficult position, but we do hear claims that the Kimberley process is not as relevant as it used to be and is not doing what it should be doing. To what extent do you believe that that's true?
Yeah, I'm also quite critical of what this process is still doing. I think the main problem with the Kimberley process is with its certification scheme. The problem with the certification scheme is to be able to give these guarantees that it gives, you actually need very strong controls to back that up. And the KP doesn't have that. So that leads actually to guarantees that are not really substantiated. And then you're misleading consumers. When you look beyond the certification scheme, the Kimberley process is doing good things when it comes to the exchange of statistics, for instance, the import-export statistics. It's something that no other commodity has, I think, or not in that level of detail. The dialogue as such, the multi-stakeholder dialogue, is valuable. It really allows you to meet country representatives, industry representatives, civil society. You can have frank discussions. You can build relations. That is also worthwhile. On a regional level, you see cooperation between countries. You have that in Western Africa, what is called the Mano River Union. These are countries that work together on combating smuggling of diamonds by harmonizing taxes. For instance, it's also a good thing. On a national level, you see progress because civil society can influence law reforms, and the mining codes are being reformed with attention for specific points raised by civil society partners and so on. So there are good things to be said as well. I think the main problem is the geopolitics that have entered, and the fact that the certification scheme is flawed. And I think if they can't update or renew the conflict diamond definition, which is quite likely, then yeah, you really have to ask the question whether this is still worthwhile to invest all this time and money in providing these certificates that have little basis. And that maybe, yeah, you need to look at other ways of what the biggest added value would be of this process.
Just moving away from the KP specifically, what are the other projects that your organization is working on at the moment?
We do a lot of projects in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and they're often involved in the mapping of artisanal mining sites. So in the east of the country, you have over the past 15 years, I think, already, we have been identifying and surveying artisanal mines. So far, we visited, I think, 3,600 of these mines already. We do that with teams of researchers that go together with technical staff of Congolese mining services that go there with long questionnaires to collect data on many different aspects: armed interference in mines, child labor, taxes, operational issues as well. And that allow us to draw conclusions on how conflict is related to artisanal mining, on the impact of due diligence and traceability efforts, for instance. I think one of the key conclusions there has been that it's really a very complex relation between conflict and artisanal mining. And not as it's often portrayed, is that the war in Congo would be over access to resources that is now again being portrayed with the conflict with Rwanda as such. It's much more complicated than that. These armed groups fight over access to land, customary power, and in that fight, they seek resources, and sometimes mines are one of the ways to get income, but there's many others. And then, for instance, roadblocks is a key use to levy taxes, and that leads to much more income for armed groups than mines. Worked more on surveying communities that live around industrial mines to see which positive, negative impacts they associate with the presence of a mining company. We've, for instance, done that in Tanzania as well. Other projects on mapping roadblocks in countries like South Sudan and Central African Republic as well.
I'm a big fan of maps, which is why it caught my attention. The purpose of those maps, is that for your purposes, so you can keep track of where everything is happening? Or is it there are people who would be interested in being able to see where everything's going on?
These maps, we mainly make them, we invest a lot in open data. So we want to allow as many different other stakeholders as possible to use them, which is why we also make them interactive. So you can online, you can play with these maps to, if you're only interested in a certain mineral or a certain region, there's a lot of different purposes. But based on our Congolese mining data, we develop what we call a responsible mining scorecard. And that allows you as a company, when you're sourcing from Congo, to look per region, which risk factors may exist or may not exist, and what how you can address them, whether it's more of a problem of, I think, of course, armed interference is a big problem, but sometimes there are other problems with illegal taxation by government services that you can maybe still find a way to deal with, or sometimes it's accident rates in artisanal mines and these kind of issues. It's a lot of this work has started in the context of a law that was introduced in the US, the Dodd-Frank Act, that had certain obligations for companies to report when they were sourcing from Congo. So the US has always been a big sponsor of this work to make sure companies have a better access to data on artisanal mining sites.
These services are something that you'll provide to dealers and retailers in, I guess, all different materials that would go into jewelry and other products.
No, also, rather than one, it's difficult to identify one specific supply chain of one single company because traceability doesn't exist today to be able to do that. So we try to inform also these multi-stakeholder networks a lot. There's the PPA on the level of the US, the Public-Private Alliance for Responsible Minerals, and you have the EPRM, which is the European counterpart of that, mainly to also assess the impact of due diligence effort or traceability schemes that have been developed for minerals like the treaty minerals in Congo or gold, and due diligence schemes to see whether the policies of governments and companies are adapted to these realities that exist. One of the conclusions we, for instance, have for now based on this huge pile of data is that due diligence schemes for gold and treaty, for instance, Eastern Congo, have managed to develop cleaner supply chains in a way to identify where you can source from and follow that flow. There's some problems of contamination always. It's hard to counter that. But I think the downside has been they have not managed to change conditions on the ground. So they basically chose areas where it's safe to work from, but this does not have an impact on the broader security conditions in mines. And we see, for instance, in the 15 years that we've been monitoring, the number of workers, the number of miners that work on mines where there's armed interference has overall stayed the same. And it's always been around 60% of miners that work on a mining site where armed actors come and interfere with operations in various kinds of ways, through taxation, through pillaging, through forced labor, and so on. So that is, I think, the problem of these schemes, that they have probably been too consumer-oriented to ensure consumers that conditions within one supply chain are okay, but they have insufficiently focused at how can we deal with the problems that still exist.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. I'm very grateful that you've explained some of these concepts to us. We've covered the obvious topics like Russia and Ukraine, but also we've been into the CAR and other issues to do with the Kimberley process. So I'm very grateful for that. And you certainly taught me a lot. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast, Hans.
No, my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, protecting consumers and supporting the global gem and jewelry trade since 1931 through research, education, and laboratory services. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Rappaport Diamond Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to get future episodes. For more discussion, news, and analysis about the diamond industry, you can visit rappaport.com, follow Rappaport Group on Instagram, and follow Rappaport on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also invite you to watch our weekly market comment videos on our YouTube channel.